Will digital currencies like Bitcoin someday become the new money? If you think the financial world has been ill-served by banks and governments in recent years, then digital currency can seem attractive. Cryptocurrencies, as they're called, circulate unregulated in the online world. And Bitcoin has excited speculators by rising in value during the past year. But are cryptocurrencies too vulnerable to hackers and too tempting for criminal transactions? I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we'll talk about digital currencies with James Angel, visiting professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and local businessman Bart Basie, who accepts Bitcoin at his Champagne Deli. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. What is money really but a concept? Not your bills or coins or even gold and silver bars, but an idea, an agreement that units of value can be transferred from one party to another. Our show today looks at a competing concept about money, money usually coming from governments with the help of government-regulated banks, and which often boils down to coins, bills, and precious metals. Compared to that, there is digital currency, or cryptocurrency, and Bitcoin is the most famous example of that. There are others as well. They have some things in common. They only exist really as computerized records, and they are established by private companies and groups, not governments and not banks. And if I've got any of this wrong, I'm sure I'll be set right by my guests today. On the phone with me is Jim Angel, and I should make this clear, this is not Illinois State climatologist Jim Angel, who was on our show the other day talking about the polar vortex. This is Professor James Angel of Georgetown University, currently a visiting professor with the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Jim, welcome to Focus.
Why, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, and especially an honor to follow in the other Jim Angel's footsteps.
Okay, I'll let him know you said that. And I gather, Jim, you're a bit of a cryptocurrency skeptic. You think there might be some problems with using at least the current versions of cryptocurrency like Bitcoin.
Yes, I'm definitely a bit skeptic. I will admit that the technology is cool and brilliant, but if you look at it through the lens of economic and monetary history, I don't think it's going to replace the currencies we have now.
And with me in the studio is a man who is using Bitcoin in day-to-day money transactions, Bart Basie. I'm make sure I have your name right, Bart.
You do.
Okay. Bart Basie owns the Cheese and Crackers Deli at the Old Farm Shops in Champaign, and Cheese and Crackers sells a lot of gourmet food items, including sandwiches. They compete with a couple of chained sandwich shops located in the same shopping center, but those other shops don't take Bitcoin, and Bart Basie does. Bart, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And if you've got any questions about Bitcoin and other types of digital currency, maybe you're using it yourself and have some experiences to tell us about. Call us at 1-800-222-9455, or you can send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Besides phone or email, you can send your questions to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Bart, I understand that your decision to give Bitcoin a try at your shop, originated with questions that arose after there's this a debit card hacking incident that involved the Schnucks supermarket chain in this area last year.
That's exactly right. What happened was I saw that, and that wasn't the first time we've seen credit card information compromised. I know that a tremendous amount of my customers appear concerned when they pull out a credit card. This is their personal information. And at that time, we were taking their card ourselves, swiping it behind the counter, handing it back to them. And so I wondered about that process and if that was the right process and if my processor was correct. So I looked around. I changed my point of sale system. I changed everything. Now we're hands-free with the credit cards. But while I was looking at that, I ran across Bitcoin. And just like Jim, I thought the technology was fascinating. I thought the technology sounded secure. And then it dawned on me that this was incredibly simple for me to accept as a form of payment. And not only could I give my customers more flexibility, because right now, of course, we take credit cards and cash. We also take UC Smiles. Here I could accept Bitcoin as well. Just again, offering one more way for my customers to pay for their salmon or halibut or whatever they came in, or sandwich, whatever they came in to buy that day. And as I looked into this and found some payment processors, it became a very simple matter to accept Bitcoin. And while when we started this months ago, we didn't get a lot of Bitcoins coming in the store. We got one or two transactions a month. Over the past week, we've seen four or five transactions a day. I am shocked at the increase. Now, in the grand scheme of things, this is a tiny volume for me. So it's a convenience to my customers. It's a way to provide them with a highly secure method of payment. There's no personal information of any kind to be compromised. And that's what I really love about Bitcoin myself.
And just a little background, Bart, you mentioned UC Smiles, and that's a sort of local currency set up by some local merchants in the area to encourage shopping at local merchants.
Exactly. It's also not backed by any government or any bank. It's just a few local merchants got together, paid a printer to print up some currency. People can buy it, and then they can spend it at local businesses just as an incentive to do business with local merchants, and then most of us give some sort of discount for using it. And the advantage to me in taking UC Smiles is similar to Bitcoin. Even though I give a discount for UC Smiles and Bitcoin has a transaction fee, these are tremendously lower fees than what I would pay for a Visa or MasterCard.
And I understand that even though, you know, at your shop you're usually not selling items that cost hundreds of dollars or anything like that, but most of it is not done in cash.
That's true. I've seen a tremendous transition in the 4 years I've been in business. Initially, about 30% of my business was cash. Today, less than 5% of my transactions are done in cash. It still surprises me.
Now, this started out with the debit card hacking incident at Schnucks, Jim. I don't know if you'd heard about that one. That's a Midwest supermarket chain that occurred some months before the big one we heard about with Target stores, but I think it's pretty similar. What makes Bitcoin feel safer than the debit cards at a big retail chain?
Well, with the Bitcoin, you don't have an account anywhere. All you have is a digital wallet with your Bitcoin numbers in it. So it's not attached to all your other personal information, your name or address or anything else. So that gives Bitcoin a little bit more privacy than a credit card number.
Is it still hackable? And maybe the bigger question is it worth somebody's while to try to do it the way that it was obviously worth somebody's while to get that information from Schnucks and Target?
Hey, anything that is valuable is worth stealing. And there have been many reports of malware basically hacking people's Bitcoin wallets. Now, to the consumer, the Bitcoin is far more dangerous than a credit card because the banks eat the credit card risk, and that's part of what they charge for. With a Bitcoin, it's like cash. If you lose that number, it's like losing a dollar bill. There's no way to get it back. If somebody hacks into your digital wallet and grabs it before you spend it, poof, it's gone.
And that's the question I want to get back to. But first, I want to ask Bart just about the nuts and bolts of how this works for someone who's never done anything with digital currency. So let's say I'm shopping at Cheese and Crackers, and I've decided to buy a pound of that Delaware Fireball salami I saw advertised on your website, and I want to pay with Bitcoin. How am I doing this?
When you walk up to the register, we ring you up as we would for any transaction. There's no difference until the very end. And then we turn around and tell you that you're at $21. And you'll tell me I'm paying with Bitcoin. I will press a second button on my register, as opposed to the one for Visa or MasterCard, or telling the register I'm taking a check. I'll press one for Bitcoin. I will then hit another button to generate a QR code. Most of my customers, or all but one or two people, have used a QR code. So you'll take your phone, which has your wallet application running on it. I now have a QR code on my screen. You scan this in. You approve the payment. Payment is then made. And when I'm doing that on my register, it's taking the U.S. dollar amount, it's using a processor called Coinbase to generate an amount in Bitcoin accurate at that moment for what Coinbase is willing to sell me Bitcoin for. So what's actually happening is the Coinbase says, okay, it's 0.0004 Bitcoin. Not sure if I got my math right. And at that point, your wallet scans the QR code. You look at your wallet app. Most wallet apps will show you the spot price in dollars as well as the Bitcoin amount. You'll hit approve or send, depending on your app, and then I have the money in my wallet.
Now, we're saying we're talking about wallets. We're not talking about literal wallets.
Not literal
wallets.
We're
talking about something that might be on your phone.
On your phone. Most of these are on your phone. Twice I've taken paper Bitcoin.
Is there paper Bitcoin?
There is. There is paper Bitcoin. There were coin Bitcoins. My understanding is no one's producing coins anymore.
How do you know a paper Bitcoin is legit and not counterfeit?
The paper Bitcoin has the Bitcoin numbers encoded on it, and so you scan those numbers, and then the same transaction occurs.
Okay. Now, the whole thing about Bitcoin is these are not dollars. These are not, say, a credit card, which would carry dollars around.
Right.
This is a whole nother currency, so it has to be, you have to essentially translate from one currency, from your currency, say your dollars, to Bitcoin by some rate of exchange.
Right, and that's where my processor and most of the processors I looked at come in. They make this really simple. You type in the number, so in my case, the $21 sale. I say this is a $21 Bitcoin sale. Coinbase instantly converts that to a Bitcoin number, a Bitcoin amount, and then pops up a QR code, the transaction occurs, I now have that much Bitcoin in my wallet, and then I can at that point immediately press another button and purchase dollars with that Bitcoin and have those dollars deposited in my bank account.
I notice that you say you do that immediately. You don't just keep it around as Bitcoin.
I do not keep it around as
why
Bitcoin.
Why do you and why do you decide to do that? Why not just let the Bitcoin pile up?
I would let the Bitcoin pile up. Perhaps if I had a single vendor, I could pay with Bitcoin.
Okay, so I mean, it's not immediately useful, and it's not going to appreciate to your favor as Bitcoin.
There are plenty of speculators out there who are buying Bitcoins as an investment vehicle. I'm not one of them, not because I don't think that's a cool way to make money or a nice way to invest. That's not what I do. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not an economist. I sell cheese and fish and sandwiches. So for me, I need to get those dollars back to pay my employees, to pay my vendors. So I'm not involved in speculating on whether the currency is going up or down. So for me, I'm holding on to those Bitcoins for maybe 15, 20 seconds.
It sounds like if you're making a transaction in Bitcoin, you're making a transaction that is not being done in money that is recognized by the law. There's just no legal recognition of Bitcoin the way there is of dollars.
That's true. And it's exactly the same as taking a UC smile. There are no particular rules about UC smiles. I also barter with some individuals in town, other businesses that provide services to me. I've done some trade. In all of these cases, whether I'm trading services with another business or I'm taking UC smiles or I'm taking Bitcoin, I'm under exactly the same legal rules to report my income.
So there's still a sales tax on a Bitcoin.
Absolutely.
Transaction.
I don't think it matters one bit to the state of Illinois or the IRS how I get that money. The fact is I made money. I owe somebody taxes on that money.
But, of course, the money has to be paid in dollars, which means you always have to have an idea of how the Bitcoin translates.
Right. So when we bring up that sandwich cost, it comes up to $7.02 after tax, and of that, there's a couple of cents of sales tax in there. So I know what that is, and then by the time I take your Bitcoin and I buy dollars with the Bitcoin, I've lost about a half a percent on the transaction right there, which is far less than the 2% I pay to take a credit card, tremendously less. It doesn't. I've still got to go and take that 10 cents of sales tax and pay that to the state of Illinois. I've still got to pay my taxes to the IRS.
This is Focus, and we're talking about Bitcoin and other digital and cryptocurrency systems with Bart Basie, who owns the Cheese and Crackers sandwich shop and deli here in Champaign and takes Bitcoin, and with Professor Jim Angel of Georgetown University, currently visiting at the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. And we'll take your calls as well. The number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Now, Jim, I was wondering, Bart takes Bitcoin, but, say, big sandwich shops like, say, Subway don't take Bitcoin. What do you think would entice a big business to do so?
Well, businesses do a cost-effectiveness measure on all their payment schemes. For example, United Airlines accepts 11 different forms of payment. So they're going to say, hey, what does it cost us to take this? And is anybody going to use it? Is it going to be worth the setup cost? Now, as Bart points out, there are a number of vendors like Coinbase and BitPay that make it fairly easy for businesses to take Bitcoin. And, you know, at first it looks really great to the business because they're not eating the credit card fee of about 2%. Now, but these other processors, you know, they have to make a living too. And so the question is, who's paying for this? So what is the exchange rate that the customer is getting on the Bitcoins? Now, right now, Bitcoins are so volatile in terms of their value that the customer really doesn't even know whether they're getting a good or a bad exchange rate. So, you know, the merchant is not taking on much currency risk, although I'm surprised that Bart is taking on even 20 seconds of currency risk. And it looks to the merchant like he's getting a lower fee. He's only losing 0.5% instead of 2%. But how much did the customer lose in currency conversion? So, you know, the payment system does not operate for free. And the question is, who pays for it? So, you know, this is an opportunity for the merchant to shift the cost to the customer, which sounds great. And indeed, if the customer really wants to pay with Bitcoins, hey, God bless them.
Well, and that brings up a question. Maybe our caller, we have a caller coming in now, has a question that relates to this area. Line 4, Bill from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very unfamiliar with this phenomenon that seems to be headed nowhere but more and more of it. My question is this, and I anything that we do in this country and probably in the world anymore has government involvement in it, whether we know it or not. And I remember 50 years ago when I worked in Chicago when some of the first credit cards came out, it was pretty clear to me that that was the beginning of a cashless society. And here we are now, and I think possibly one of the dark sides of this whole thing is, again, to drive cash out of the society. So every transaction, every asset that anybody owns is quantified and available to the government to look at. And I'm curious as to what you think about that.
Well, I want to ask that to you, Bart. I mean, first, for starters, you don't get much cash at your shop. People decide to use something else. Why do they tell you in the case of Bitcoin that they want to use Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is, people who are spending Bitcoin like the anonymity and the security. Bitcoin is very, very similar to cash in the sense that it's not traceable and it's not trackable. Jim pointed out that if you lose your Bitcoin number, you've lost your Bitcoin. There's no record of it anywhere. There's no way to reconstruct what it was. So unlike a credit card transaction, nobody can help you. And can they be stolen? Yes. This is why people print out Bitcoins. People will copy Bitcoins to independent hardware devices, USB sticks, hard drives they take offline, things like that, in order to protect them. Because just like cash, it's something that you don't want stolen. But the Bitcoin, the whole point of it is that like cash, it is completely untraceable. There's no way to tell who used it. We think, because of what happened with the Silk Road, that the government is unable to trace Bitcoin transactions.
Now, that we're getting, in a sort of backdoor into a whole big story here. First of all, who said, was that you, Jim, who just said not true?
That was me. That's one of the myths about Bitcoin. It is not an anonymous currency. The whole thing that makes it work is the public ledger, a thing called the blockchain of every single transaction. So you can see what wallet number from to what wallet number to. So transactions are traceable with difficulty. So your name is not necessarily attached to your wallet address. So there's a little bit of anonymity there, but what makes it work is the fact that every transaction actually is public. and that it is verified by a network of so-called miners who are operating computers that are verifying all the transactions. So it is one of the myths of Bitcoin to say it's an anonymous system. Now, there are some sites out there, tumblers as they're called, which will try to sort of shred, you know, transactions into lots of little things, making it harder to trace. But it is a myth to say that Bitcoin is anonymous. That there are serious privacy considerations here because every transaction can be tracked, but you may not know who belongs to a particular wallet address.
I don't know how far we can carry on this thread. Our listener, Bill, who called in, I gather from what you said that really you prefer cash. And cash is something which I guess is anonymous as long as you don't tell the person that you're transacting with who you are. And I think Bill has left us. Thank you for the call, though, Bill, and getting us started on this thread. And actually, even Bart, when we were talking off air, I got the impression you like cash too.
I like cash. I don't know a merchant who doesn't like cash. There's a tiny fee associated with checks. There's a tiny fee associated with Bitcoins, a bit larger with Visa. But cash, there are no fees to me. So, yes, I like cash. I wish I could come up with a way to encourage my customers to use cash. Right now, Bitcoin was something that I could do to provide my customers with a little greater sense of security and privacy. And while I completely agree with Jim, the blockchain is a record of every transaction, he and I don't agree on how anonymous you become as a result of that. And when I look at some of the criminal activity, I have yet to see a case, and there might be one out there, but I haven't seen one yet, where the government's been able to use the Bitcoin transactions to tie parties together. It looks like, especially with the Silk Road, which was a huge case, and the government certainly wanted to break this website, and they did a great job of taking down this illegal website, but they weren't able to do it on the basis of the blockchain. And because of that, Bitcoin prices started to go up a little bit afterwards, and there's a sense of security that, while yes, the blockchain records the fact that a Bitcoin was spent and a Bitcoin was received, the actual users at either end of the wallets have the ability to remain anonymous if they want to. Now, in my case, I'm not anonymous. My customers are so not anonymous, most of them will stand there. They're excited to use Bitcoin. They'll sign up for my mailing list. You know, we'll shake hands and have a chuckle over Bitcoin. Isn't this cool?
So it's not really relevant to the purchases that you're doing.
I don't think it is.
But in the case of the Silk Road, let's open this up a little bit for people who aren't familiar with it. The Silk Road is or was a website in which illegal transactions such as drugs were being conducted.
Yes.
And apparently some people were using Bitcoin to do this, and some promoters of Bitcoin, I'm not quite sure of the right word of it, have been arrested and charged in connection with this. Excuse me, Jim, maybe you can fill in a little more about what happened with the Silk Road.
Right. Well, as you point out, Silk Road was an underground website that allowed people to buy and sell anything regardless of the legality of it, and the currency that was used was Bitcoin. And as you so eloquently pointed out, the promoters of Silk Road were recently arrested and charged with money laundering and conspiracy and a bunch of other nasty things. And this is something that is part of the maturation of Bitcoin as a payment system, in that if its only use is for drug dealers and terrorists, society is not going to accept that kind of an illegal conduit. Although, of course, the cyber libertarians go, that's the idea, man. But, you know, there are pretty good reasons why we have the anti-money laundering laws. There are some really good reasons why we regulate our financial markets. We want to make sure that the crooks are not stealing the money from our wallets. So we demand regulation of our financial system. And for Bitcoin to be anything more than a, cute toy, it's going to have to, come out of the shadows and be regulated like other money processors.
Bart, what do you feel about a Bitcoin or some sort of cryptocurrency that would be a regulated currency?
When the Silk Road thing came down and these guys got busted, the customers that I have who use Bitcoin were elated. They were so happy that finally this huge, notorious, illegal thing was gone. And they were thrilled because these people are people who, they like Bitcoin, they support it for their own reasons, and the last thing they wanted was it tied to any illegal activity. So Jim and I completely agree on this. Anything you can do to get this currency more mainstream, more viewed as legitimate. Now, Jim and I may disagree. I don't think a currency has to be backed by a government necessarily for legitimacy. I think if you have a community of practice that can make something legitimate. However, I do agree with Jim completely that if there were some government regulations and rules around it, that would increase the overall comfort level of consumers. We'd see more people using it, which I think overall is a good thing. And my back of the napkin math says it's a little cheaper for a customer to pay me with a Bitcoin than with a Visa card, with their fees, my fees, and everything in between. So I'd like to encourage my customers to use it. It seems secure and safe. And if Jim thinks that some government rules and regulations would help the overall consumer confidence level, I think that's a great idea. I'd like to see this more widely adopted. It appears to be safe and secure as long as you, like the cash in your pocket, don't lose it, don't lose your numbers. Whether you print them out on paper, store them offline, choose to store them in the cloud with somebody, you know, you've got to make a decision on what's secure with your coins.
Well, let's take a short break at this point, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Bart Basie, Champagne Businessman, taking Bitcoin, and with Finance Professor Jim Angel about Bitcoin and this type of currency, this cryptocurrency. Excuse me. This is Focus on WYLL. And welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We are discussing the Bitcoin phenomenon with Jim Angel, visiting professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and Bart Basie, who welcomes Bitcoin at his place of business, Cheese and Crackers in Champaign. Remember, your comments are welcome at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WYLL. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. A few moments ago, we were talking about one aspect of Bitcoin that you say you would welcome some change to, and that, Jim, you say that it needs, and that's the idea of government regulation. But also the idea I wanted to ask about right now is that the idea that it is an independent currency, not set to a government currency, not set by a bank. And Jim, you wrote a piece on the CNET website, actually in reply to a pro-Bitcoin article in the New York Times, and one of the things that you said is you believe it should be tied to a currency.
Well, yes. The underlying technology of having a payment system that allows open entry into the processing business is really cool. Okay. As a matter of fact, when I first heard about Bitcoin, I thought about becoming a Bitcoin miner, but I figured it wasn't worth the electricity to me. But the technology there is great. We are in the midst of a payment revolution. If you think about how payments have changed over the last few years, we're going to see many more changes over the next few years. We're going to find ever better ways of completing transactions. So, you know, the technology behind Bitcoin is great, but it can also be applied to legacy currencies as well, so that you don't need to have the, Bitcoin 0.9, as the current protocol is known, as, you know, the standard for all time. So, you know, we can leapfrog this technology and come up with something even better. But as it currently stands right now, you know, Bitcoin is really, I think of it as beta coin, that there are, you know, a lot of risks here to the consumer and to the financial system and to the merchants that we may not have even figured out yet. The technology appears to be okay, but we've seen lots of technologies that we thought were safe that later blew up, you know, whether it was the space shuttle or the 787 batteries, that we really won't know what the vulnerabilities are until some bad person exploits them.
Well, I'm wondering that if part of the attractiveness of Bitcoin as a separate currency to some people is because they've seen, as far as they're concerned, some legacy currencies blow up, and that the recession and the financial problems of the last few years were, in their eyes, due to problems on the part of financial regulators and banks, and that they wanted another option. Can you see a world where something like Bitcoin, maybe more than one something like Bitcoin, exists as a supplemental form of currency alongside the currencies of governments?
Well, the issue is who controls that supplemental currency. You know, there are right now hundreds of currency providers on the planet with various countries, various Bitcoin copy coins, and so forth. You have local script like the UC Smiles. You have Disney dollars at Disneyland. There are lots of payment media floating throughout the planet. The question is who controls it. Now, one of the other myths of Bitcoin is that the amount is limited. Well, the Bitcoin protocol is basically accepted by the people who use Bitcoin. And mining is becoming quite concentrated, with some mining pools having approximately a third of the computer horsepower. And
we need to open it up a bit, because mining is the metaphorical word that they use for what I gather is the production of Bitcoin currency, but I have no idea what that means.
Let me try to explain it, and hopefully I won't get too geeky on it. You see, the beauty of Bitcoin is that you allow anybody with a computer to process the transactions. When you do a transaction, you broadcast it out to the internet. All these so-called miners use their computers to look at it. They timestamp it to make sure nobody has counterfeited that Bitcoin. And they do some math problems along the way to make it a little bit difficult. And they essentially, and this is a gross oversimplification, and the true Bitcoin nerds will say, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But they essentially vote to verify each transaction. And whoever has the majority of the processing power at that moment in the network essentially dominates. So you have a bunch of almost independent computers that are voting on each transaction to say, yeah, that's a real transaction. We're going to add it to the blockchain.
Bart, how does this work out in the real world for you when you're using Bitcoin?
So when I'm using it, this determines how long it takes that transaction to confirm, because I need both the coin to confirm that it's left and the coin to confirm that it's in my wallet, and then I need a confirmation that it's left my wallet and I've bought the dollars with it. So I'm waiting for two separate confirmations out of the blockchain. I thought Jim's explanation was on target there. This blockchain is a record of transactions. There are millions of people around the world running their computers, most of them in groups of computers or pools, and they're maintaining this blockchain. As a reward today for participating in this, every so often, somebody will get 25 bitcoins. That's their payment for doing this work. It's a lot of work. The blockchain today, I'm guessing, is 7 gigs. This is a lot of data, and it's a lot of work to do this. Eventually, there won't be the issuance of new Bitcoin. There will simply be the transaction fees inside the network that pays these people. But these are the miners. They're maintaining the system. So the interesting thing for me is that I liken them to the printer of UC Smiles. So UC Smiles has an organization in Urbana, part of the University of Illinois, that supports it. They go out, they pay a printer to print up the currency. These miners are doing that job. They are the organizational factor running the Bitcoin software, maintaining the blockchain, maintaining the network.
Is there any time when a transaction might be rejected?
Yes. And the concern here is that, and this is where he was going, I think, with the voting concept, is that if you have a bad transaction sent to the network, if you have more processors who agree to it than disagree, the transaction will be accepted. So the potential major exploit in the system is if you could get enough machines running to outweigh the good guys out there, you could conceivably add bad data to the blockchain. Now, right now, the general feeling is there's critical mass, and even with large botnets, people wouldn't be able to overwhelm the system or come up with more bad actors than good. Does that make sense?
How does I want to run that by Jim. Is that the idea right there? Are you saying that?
Right. Yeah, the argument is that, yes, if anybody, you know, controlled the majority of the computing horsepower in the network at any moment, they could do bad things. They could essentially counterfeit bitcoins. They could mess up the blockchain. Now, what would stop a state actor or a terrorist organization? Oh, and the argument is, even if somebody controlled 51%, they wouldn't want to do it because it would be economic suicide. But what would stop an Al-Qaeda or other terrorist group that wanted to disrupt the monetary system?
Well, this is where I think it's beautiful. What stops it right now are the sheer numbers. Al-Qaeda doesn't have the numbers. Bitcoin's bigger than a lot of small countries. So in terms of numbers of people actually processing, number of miners, given that huge amount of horsepower out there, while it's theoretically possible, right now it doesn't seem reasonable that the system would be compromised from there. The bigger worries with Bitcoin today, and I think the more clear worries, are things like having your Bitcoin stolen. So if you put them in a cloud with one of the large processors, Coinbase, Mt. Gox, whoever you're using, there is always the potential for things to be stolen, which is gets me right back to where I was initially with the data breach that Schnucks had. So you can have data breaches if you allow your information to be stored in the cloud. And then, of course, if you keep your Bitcoins printed on paper and stuffed in your sock drawer, well, then you're liable for potentially a house fire or a burglar.
Now, this brought up a question to me. If something, if I lose money, or if something happens to my credit card, there are policing agencies I can contact. The credit card company may back me up on this. If I lose Bitcoin, can I call the police?
You can call the police because you've lost. There's absolute value. And I'll tell you this, if you can't call the police, then I wouldn't think the IRS could collect taxes on it. And I know they can take taxes on it. So, no, there's value there, and it's no different than any other object of value. Whether or not you want to call it a currency, I don't know if there is a legal definition of a currency.
Bitcoin, can you insure it?
Well, I would think you could insure almost anything, so I don't know. That would be a question for
someone
else.
You haven't claimed it in your insurance policies. But
no, I have not.
But I gather also if you're only doing 4 or 5 transactions a day.
Right. I mean, a big Bitcoin day for me is $200 or $300 of Bitcoin. I think my highest day ever was $310 in Bitcoin. So it is a tiny bit of my transactions. But again, for me and my consumers, there aren't a lot of worries about, the stability of the currency. They think it's really cool to come in and buy a piece of fish with Bitcoin. So it's more of a novelty item for me today.
Now, Jim, you were talking about whether or not cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin become something more than a novelty item. Is there an in-between stage between dominant currency and a novelty item that things like cryptocurrencies might inhabit?
Well, actually, that is a good point. I mean, I think for now it's a novelty item that it's demonstrated its utility in the underground economy, so I think it will stick around in that niche for a long time.
By underground economy, do you mean criminal economy, or do you mean other sorts of underground economies?
I basically mean Silk Road-type operations.
Okay, because I was wondering if it also might play a role. There are parts of the world where if I go to a country like Somalia, I don't know how workable, say, Somalian currency is right now. So I might use some other sorts of currencies. It might be a euro or a U.S. dollar, but maybe it might be some sort of cryptocurrency like Bitcoin just to get through the day.
And that's one of the more promising value propositions that the Bit proponents put forward, the idea that, oh, look, foreign currency transactions are too expensive right now. And, we can digitally ship a Bitcoin number around the world almost for free. And there's a lot to be said for that. And as I said, there is a payment revolution going on. Bitcoin is not the only innovation going on right now. Just about every financial organization is trying to figure out better ways of processing payments, and that includes cross-border payments as well. So, yeah, definitely. But, you know, the problem is in an underdeveloped place like Somalia, yes, the local script is quite questionable and the normal infrastructure doesn't really work. But Bitcoin depends upon a robust technological infrastructure. It depends on your having a good internet connection. So, you know, having somebody in the middle of nowhere with a BitWallet on their phone, you know, if there's no cell phone tower nearby, or that cell phone tower doesn't have an internet connection, or it's not going to be that useful. And when you look at the billions of the unbanked on the planet, a lot of them in developing countries are using mobile telephone-based payment system. You know, they've sort of leapfrogged us in the developing world. And, you know, we're going to see many more payment solutions coming forward. So Bitcoin is just one of a number of innovations we're seeing in the payment space. And right now, it's a cool novelty. You know, with some additional tweaks, you know, that technology could be applied more widely. And I think that's what's leading to a lot of the buzz about it, because it is a cool technology.
Still time for your feedback about Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies for Professor Jim Angel and for Bart Bazy. Here on Focus, our phone number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. A couple of questions I want to catch up on. We had an email from someone asking, and I believe you used the phrase QR code.
Yes.
Just to give people an idea, what are we talking about?
So this is a little barcode that pops up on my screen, on my register, and then you with your cell phone, with your wallet app, will scan that code in, and that's all it is. The QR code is actually going to point you to a Bitcoin address, which will then facilitate the transaction. It shows the amount and the processor and all of that data behind it. But essentially, it's just a barcode, so your wallet app knows this request has been made to find the request. In addition to that, I've had people who don't have that, and we've had to punch in their email or send them the information another way. So there's a variety of ways I can take Bitcoin payment, but more than 99% have all been with a QR code, which is essentially a barcode. You scan it on your phone, and then the payment is made.
Bart, I'm just wondering, of the folks who have been coming in to use Bitcoin at your shop, is it mostly a guy thing, or is it men and women who are coming in?
No, it's men and women. It is not mostly a guy thing. It's a good question, but no, it's a pretty even mix.
Okay, that's interesting there. Jim, I'm wondering, in what you've been looking at about Bitcoin and things like it, are there any groups of people, sectors of the economy, you know, where is the interest of this? Where has it been showing up?
Well, it started off in the computer community, the people who are into encryption and that type of technology, because that's where it evolved from. And, you know, so it started as this sort of, you know, techie thing. And it morphed into what I call the cyber libertarians, people who are technologically quite savvy and also have a real libertarian bent. You know, they don't like government controls on what we do. And they tend to think of Bitcoin as a cyber gold standard, but it really isn't, for a number of reasons. You know, it's one of the other great myths of Bitcoin to say the amount is limited. Under the current protocol, it actually, you know, theoretically is limited at 21 million Bitcoins, but the protocol can change. And, you know, so there are all these governance issues over, you know, who can control the protocol. And indeed, if it ever did take off as a mainstream system, I think that people would demand that there would be public accountability by the people running the protocol.
Well, maybe this goes into a couple of questions that have been emailed to us. Mike writes, and I think he's asking you, Jim, can you clarify the idea of an exchange rate between Bitcoin and dollars? Mike asks, if it fluctuates, like, say, the shekel versus the dollar, wouldn't a purchase potentially be more or less expensive than paying in dollars, depending on the exchange rate that day? And how does this benefit the consumer if you have no idea what you're actually paying for something from day to day? Let me run that by you, Jim, and then let me ask Bart to chime in as well.
Well, I think the emailer has exactly the right question. that it's great for the merchant because you're not really taking any currency risk, but the consumer is now taking on the currency risk. Now, the values of Bitcoin have been fluctuating wildly. It's still in its Wild West days. So
I understand it's actually, I guess, appreciated over the last year.
Oh, the value exploded in the last year. It went from, pennies to a few dollars, and now it's approximately $900 per Bitcoin. So anybody who got a stash of Bitcoins a year ago is sitting and held on to them is sitting very pretty today.
But that could certainly change.
Change overnight.
Exactly.
It's all about the faith the community has in the Bitcoin, which I don't know if that's tremendously different than a lot of currencies out there. I know in the 80s, Turkey's currency fluctuated wildly, a tremendous inflation. Today, that country's back with some inflation problems. People over there are buying a lot of U.S. dollars right now as a hedge against inflation. And Bitcoin over there has taken off a bit. I know in my case, with my wallet app and most of my customer wallet apps, when they've shown them to me, they'll be shown exactly what they're spending in dollars for their processor. So when they scan the QR code, what pops up on their wallet app is, here's the amount of Bitcoins that have been requested. Here's that amount in dollars if you were to buy dollars from us right now. So, my customer sees that the 702 in dollars to them might be 701 or 703. There could be a fluctuation there. So Jim's right that it could change. For the dollar amounts we're talking about, it is small. However, the idea that the consumer doesn't know exactly what they're spending is not correct with most wallet apps. The wallet apps I've seen, you know what you're spending in the moment relative to the currency that you purchased them with.
We had another email come in wondering how the term legal tender would be used in connection with Bitcoin. Would Bitcoin be illegal tender? I mean, does this phrase mean anything when you're talking about cryptocurrency, about an independent currency?
Well, that's a good question. I am not now, nor have I ever been, an attorney, so I'm not going to render a legal opinion here. But, the phrase legal tender comes from the so-called legal tender laws, which basically say you can use U.S. currency to pay debt. So in other words, if I owe you some money, I can actually, hand you some of those, physical pieces of paper that say legal tender on it, and you're forced to accept that.
Essentially, now, a court says that is okay, the debt is paid. But if that was done with something else like Bitcoin, maybe the recipient would accept it, maybe not, but the court would not necessarily accept it.
Exactly. I mean, as far as payments go, whatever two consenting parties agree to is generally considered legal by the court. But, if you owe your taxes, generally the government only wants legal tender for taxes. And indeed, that's how governments force the use of their currency, by saying, hey, you got to pay your taxes in our legal tender currency.
Bart, what do you see happening in the future with Bitcoin? At your shop, do you expect this to be a bigger part of your business transactions in the next few years?
Absolutely. I do expect this to continue to grow over the next few years. You talk about things like, we're going to run out of Bitcoins, or we're going to, have them all out there, and maybe there'll be more, maybe there won't. That's not really my concern. My concern is this something my customers want to use? Is this something that I can provide them safely and efficiently? I can say yes to all those boxes. Right now, the growth that I've seen in my Bitcoin has been phenomenal, although it went from very tiny to small, right? It's not a major item for me. The funny thing is, though, in January, I took more Bitcoin than I did checks.
Well, that's not good news for checks, I guess, as far as a popular form of transaction.
No, so I see it growing, yes.
Jim Angel, I wanted to ask you, this has been something I think, as you noted, tech people like. The traditional finance community, maybe not so much. What do you think they want to see happen with this?
Well, I'd say there are sort of two streams of thought here. People in the payment community know there's a payment revolution going on, and that there are lots of different things that people are coming up with. Some of them will succeed, some of them won't. So some people look at this as yet another innovation in currencies, in payments. We'll see what happens. People look at it from a monetary systems perspective, sort of think of it as people trying to return to the gold standard. And anybody who's looked at financial history realizes that the gold standard was a disaster for the economy. That when you have the money supply fixed and the only thing that determines how much money you have in the economy is whether the miners are lucky this year, it led to serious problems in the economy. And if you looked at 19th and early 20th century financial history, we had the equivalent of the Great Recession every 10 years. You know, every 10 years, the financial system would collapse. So it turns out that having a little bit of flexibility in the monetary system, having a government agency that has the flexibility to step in when there's a crisis, is actually a really good thing. Now, has it always been done right? No. But I think we're better off with it than we are without it. So, you know, people who've learned the lessons of the past go, no, we don't really want a digital gold standard, even though that's what a lot of the early BIT proponents would like to see.
And that's where I'm going to have to break it off now. Can't even get to the man who was writing on the Forbes website a few days ago proposing that Bitcoin be put on the gold standard. That would be a whole nother kettle of fish. But I want to thank both of you for talking for the time we had today about Bitcoin. Bart Basie, local businessman here in Champaign with Cheese and Crackers, and Professor Jim Angel of Georgetown University, currently visiting at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. This is Focus on WYLL.